Hello and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album. It's Ben Burrell here. We are continuing to look at O Mercy on this episode. It's O Mercy Revisited Part 2. Of course it is. I wanted to say thank you to you if you sent me a message after the last episode. Had some messages that were very nice. Had some coffees as well. If you bought me a coffee, thank you so much for that. That's like an internet tipping system if you aren't aware of it. I was not aware of it until a few years ago. You can spend like $3 buying me a coffee. I literally do function on caffeine these days. So if you want to do that, if you're someone that's enjoyed the podcast and you want to send a little virtual tip, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. The link is in this episode's description. Let's get to part two on O Mercy, shall we? I love this record. It's a classic in my opinion. What I think is interesting about it as well, and this is just coming to me, I don't know if I mentioned this in the episodes or not. Probably did. But I think it's interesting, almost unique in the fact that a lot of these songs take place in a similar atmosphere to the one they were recorded in. I can hear a lot of these songs happening in like a New Orleans kind of hot night in a big dark house, maybe like the one Bob recorded the album in with Daniel Lanois. So I guess it's interesting that that these songs share a lot with the atmosphere they were recorded in. Just a little random thought for you there. You're welcome. I could talk about this album for hours. And in fact, I do. So let's get back to it, shall we? This is part two on O Mercy. It's Bob Dylan Album by Album, and this is O Mercy Revisited. With two songs already in the bank, Dylan and Lanois must have entered the third O Mercy session in buoyant mood. There were some new faces in the room that day too. The pair were joined in this session by Willie Green, nicknamed Mean Willie Green, who had been the Neville Brothers drummer for 30 years. They were also joined by a Neville brother too, Cyril Neville to be precise. Both Neville and Green lived closely. Lanois joked that one of New Orleans' funkiest had lived in the next neighbourhood. How cool is that, he says. Mean Willie Green was just one fast phone call away. He was also complimentary of Cyril's playing too. He says, to be in a room with Cyril and Charles and all of those guys, that was really something else. Both these people are crucial to this record. They are like soldiers in Lanois' sound battle. They really do help to make that swampy sound, as Lanois calls it. They weird the record up just enough to give it its curious nature. Also present in that session, remaining from the previous one, was Michael Byrne. He was the album's keyboard player for the most part, but also its engineer too. In his book Soul Mining, Lanois details the setup of the studio. Like we saw in the previous episode, it was Dylan and Lanois face-to-face for much of the studio time, but this was opened out too. He says, "The O Mercy studio was essentially a kitchen. Bob and I sat like two guys on a porch. He played my nice 1952 Butterscotch Telecaster that I plugged into an early 60s Fender concert amp that was tucked around the corner, 5 feet from Bob, with moving blankets around the mic to avoid vocal spill. When Bob moved to an acoustic guitar, he played my Gibson Country Western model, which was from the late 50s. I used a Lawrence clip-on mic to pick it all up, and I ran the acoustic through the same Fender concert, so Bob's guitar sound was always coming from the same amp, whether it be electric or acoustic. As for myself, I mostly played my Steelbody Dobro from the 20s. Its neck was as thick as an oar. That was the rig. We never changed it. My Pavey bass from Mississippi was plugged in, and at the end of the night, if we had a take, I would overdub the bass parts. Michael Byrne, who was engineering, would also play some keyboards at the console, if we needed it, that is. As Lanois sat in front of Bob, to his left was the drum kit placed there for Willie Green, and to the left of that was Cyril Neville, who in this session was utilising a cowbell and some bongos. At the start of a session, they attempted the tracks most of the time, and What Was It You Wanted, but neither made the grade. Neville and Green, though, came into their own on the first successful song of the session. That was the album opener, Political World. What's amazing about this song is that, for the most part, the rhythm guitar is only really playing one chord. It's played again and again and again, just going round and round and round. Sometimes Lanois throws in some industrial guitars over the top, or some nice little riffs. But that furious chord just keeps going and going and going. While this one called Wonder is the starting place for the actual physical album being the opener, it's also the starting place for its creative journey too. In his memoir Chronicles Volume 1, Dylan mentions the creative dry spell we heard about earlier. This seems to have been combined with a hand injury that he never really elaborates on, but in many ways, perhaps intentionally, seems to represent what is happening to him. This song is the real genesis for Oh Mercy. It's the first one that makes up that purple patch he would stumble into. And Dylan writes, "One night when everyone was asleep, I was sitting at the kitchen table. There was nothing on the hillside but a shiny bed of lights. All that changed. I wrote about 20 verses for a song called Political World, and this was about the first of 20 songs I would write in the next month or so. With the song, I thought I might have broken through to something. It was like you wake up from a deep and drugged slumber and somebody strikes a little silver gong and you come to your senses." Referring to his injured hand, he says, "I wouldn't have written this song and the ones that would come with it if I hadn't have been laid up." It appears that fate was playing its role in this album too. Once again, on this song, we're hearing of a world that has lost its way. Truly, this is a theme that Dylan has stuck with more than any other, perhaps. But it is a little different here. It's more of an attack on the modern world rather than a simple painting of a broken world. Take the third line in the first verse, for example. Dylan sings, "We live in a political world where love don't have any place. We're living in times where men commit crimes and crimes don't have a face." Bob then goes full grumpy, not so young man, with lines like, "We live in a political world. Wisdom is thrown in jail. It rots in a cell misguided as hell, leaving no one to pick up the trail." By the end, as Bob tends to do, we find that not even the Almighty can help. He sings, "We live in a political world. Everything is hers or his. Climb into the frame and shout God's name, but you're never sure what it is." In Chronicles, he talks about the song's inspiration. He says, "Sometimes things you see and hear outside of yourself can influence a song. The song Political World could have been triggered by current events. There was a heated presidential race underway. You couldn't avoid hearing about it. But I had no interest in politics as an art form, so I don't think that was all there was to it. The song is too broad." Elsewhere, he compares it to another song of his, a cut from Empire Burlesque called Clean Cut Kid. This is a song actually left over from the Infidel sessions. It's a song that underneath some pretty naff sonics is also a political song. The message is the clean cut kid is an average American kid who's radically altered by his experience in the Vietnam War. Bob sings, "They gave him dope to smoke, drinks and pills, a Jeep to drive, blood to spill." The lyrics here are alluding to the US military plying servicemen with speed and steroids and painkillers to help them handle extended combat. Later, we hear how they are then tossed back into society after the war with lines like, "They said congratulations, you got what it takes. They sent him back into the rat race without any breaks." Finally, the grim ending is spelled out for us in no uncertain terms. As Bob sings, "He could have sold insurance, owned a restaurant or a bar, could have been an accountant or a tennis star. He was wearing boxing gloves, took a dive one day off the Golden Gate Bridge into China Bay." So just like in Clean Cut Kids, Political World sees the world or society taking everything from its inhabitants. We live in a political world. Courage is a thing of the past. The houses are haunted. Children aren't wanted. Your next day could be your last. In Chronicles, Dylan speaks of this place, this political world where clean-cut kids are used like tools. It's an underworld of sorts. He says, "The political world is more of an underworld, not the world where men live, toil, and die like men." This quote is interesting to me, and it reminds me of a novel I read. It's called Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky. I read it in lockdown, and it mentions a similar place. In the book, our narrator has turned his back on society and is dwelling underground. Bob has mentioned Dostoevsky before, and he has called him an influence. But this doesn't feel like this book is directly influencing this song, or even this is a reference to it. But they do form companion pieces, and maybe will give us some sort of idea of what Bob is getting at in this song. In Notes from Underground, the narrator is overwhelmed by the world, and it feels like Dylan is getting at the same thing in Political World. There are verses for this song that are along the same lines as the one found on the famous O Mercy take, but it has to be said, they're not quite as good. One reads, "We live in a political world, flags flying in the breeze, comes out of the blue, moves towards you like a knife cutting through cheese." I don't know, that's not my favourite Bobby line. In the studio, though, it seems the song was a point of frustration. Of an early session for the song, Bob says, "We tried Political World a few different ways. It didn't seem to be going anywhere. The sensation was always the same. The first way we tried it was as good as the last. But someplace along the line, as the night wore on, Lanois got committed to a funk." He continues elsewhere saying, "The following day I went back to the studio and the song was played for me again, except this time it was even more funked up. A lot of work had continued after I'd left the night before. My guitar was taken out of the mix entirely. My voice was out there in the middle of nowhere in some corridor of sonic atmosphere." Bob didn't seem too impressed. He says he had an exchange with Lanois that went something along the lines of this. Bob: "Christ, all this happened while I was out of here?" Lanois: "Yeah, what do you think?" Bob: "I think we missed it." Lanois is then silent as Bob goes into the kitchenette behind the courtyard and grabs a beer out of the refrigerator before sinking into a chair. Things got even worse later as Dylan wanted the song to sound like an upbeat ballad. Lanois tried to get that sound, but there was a problem. The drums from Willie Green were cut to the guitar part from Mason Ruffler, not Dylan's guitar. When they decided to resurrect Bob's performance, they found it was out of time with everything. Dylan says they lost a couple of days apparently messing around with this. It came to a head as Lanois lost it with Bob. He says, "Lanois flashed into a rage. He swung around, flinging a metallic dobro like it was some kind of toy and smashed it to the floor with furious actions. There was a momentary silence in the room. A young girl who had been cataloguing tracks and taking notes left in tears." Eventually, they did get it, though. They rebuilt the whole thing. There was some overdubs to be done, with Bob adding some guitar in a later session. Alongside Political World in this session, though, they got another track. Track 8, Disease of Conceit. A lot of O Mercy is wrapped up in the downfall of man. Political World and the song Dylan connected it to, Clean Cut Kid, represent that. So does Everything is Broken and Man in the Long Black Coat. They all have those themes too. And in many ways, so does What Good Am I's self-questioning, as does the bittersweet memories of Shooting Star. In all those songs, a narrator is a sort of outcast, turning their back or having a back turned upon them. But Disease of Conceit seems to be the centre of it all. Conceit is excessive pride in oneself, which might pair this song with What Good Am I's sort of person analysis. Except this time it's outward looking rather than internal. And Dylan talks of its meaning in Chronicles. He says, "Conceit is not necessarily a disease, it's more of a weakness. A conceited person could be set up easily and brought down accordingly. Let's face it, a conceited person has a fake sense of self-worth, an inflated opinion of himself. A person like this can be controlled and manipulated completely if you know what buttons to push." So he's talking about a weakness that lots of people have. And the song could be inspired by a real-life person too. Dylan alludes to this in his writing, although he's unsure if this is the actual genesis of the song. However, he talks of the defrocking of televangelist Jimmy Swaggart. Swaggart was a big deal in the 70s and the 80s. At the height of his popularity, his religious telecast was transmitted to over 3,000 stations and cable systems each week. He went on tours of the US and Canada and Europe and Africa and South America. He also played piano too. He sold in excess of 17 million albums. In fact, in 1980, he even received a Grammy Award nomination for Best Performance for a Traditional Gospel Song.
"I felt the Holy Spirit tell me that's what I want you to use Sunday. When I walk through the door, I felt his presence. And I knew this was the place where love abounds."
However, in 1988, he was embroiled in a sex scandal involving a prostitute. he apparently had been caught on film leaving a prostitute's motel room in sweatpants. Surely the sweatpants would be enough for him to be immediately defrocked, but I'm sure the whole prostitute thing played a role too. Dylan writes about how strange the story felt to him. He mentioned that clearly the televangelist wasn't in good shape, but he also mentions the hypocrisy of the whole story. He says, "The story didn't make any sense to me. The Bible is full of these things. A lot of those old kings and leaders had many wives, and Hosea the prophet was even married to a prostitute. It didn't stop him from being a holy man. But these times were different, and for Swaggart, it was the end of the line. Reality can be overwhelming. It can also be a shadow, depending on how you look at it." "Reality can be overwhelming" is a sentence that can sum up Dylan's output pretty much from Oh Mercy onwards. And it's interesting he calls reality a shadow there after we had last year's Shadow Kingdom performance. For me, this is a dark world, that apocalyptic landscape that Dylan likes to dwell in, the underworld he's mentioned before, and Swaggart is a good story for that, a man tripped up by his situation and the world he's in. At least that seems to be Dylan's perspective anyway. He almost relinquishes Swaggart from all responsibility, as he writes, "I wondered what this harlot might look like that lured this famous preacher into rolling in the muck. A damsel of tempting statuesque beauty, probably. I mean, it does take two to tango, Bob. Let's not forget that." Anyway, Swaggart and the corruption of a person is where the song seems to find its meaning. Like a lot of protagonists on Oh Mercy, someone is tainted. Here, it's by themselves and the situation they find themselves in. Their conditioning has meant that they can feel like they are more important than they are. The beggar has believed he is a king. Perhaps Swaggart thought he could behave like that and get away with it. Like he was too big for a downfall. Dylan sings, "Give you delusions of grandeur and an evil eye. Give you the idea you're too good to die. They bury you from head to your feet, from the disease of conceit." Apparently, according to Bob, there were other lyrics that didn't make the cut for this song too. And again, just like we saw before, they're not quite as good as the ones on the final cut. An alternative verse for this song reads, "There's a whole lot of people dreaming tonight about the disease of conceit. Whole lot of people screaming tonight about the disease of conceit. I'll hump you and I'll dump you and I'll blow your house down. I'll slice into your cake before I leave town. Pick a number, take a seat with the disease of conceit." I don't know if Dylan is trolling us with these alternative lines and the ever-present food vibe to them, although I will say that hump you is a phrase that is sorely missing from Dylan's oeuvre. Bob finished the writing for these lyrics at home. He had been to the emergency room to have that mysterious hand injury checked out, and upon returning, he spent some time with his son and his son's soon-to-be wife. Apparently, they were cooking a seafood stew, another curious level of detail that we get in Chronicles, and another mention of food. I'm sure this is a reference to something that will be uncovered at some stage. He then goes down to his studio on his Malibu house's grounds and completes the words for the song. He notes the song's gospel tones in its production, which again could be a nod to Swaggart. It certainly fits the tale of the song too. By the time they go to New Orleans and in the studio, they record the song four times. Each has Dylan at the piano. He says there was a thunderstorm going on as they cut it, and it became a weeper blues song with a, quote, insistent beat and that B-flat giving the whole thing a dark edge. He even talks about how he would have liked the song to be backed with a march sound from a funeral band. But I think the Oh Mercy cut is just fine. And so did Lanwha. And when Dylan asked what he thought, Lanwha said they should leave it alone and that it was finished. Maybe after Lanwha smashing that guitar previously, Dylan felt he would agree with him this time. Dylan's piano chords, as he describes them, are blocked. They are very deliberate, not clunky, but they're definitely not fluid. They sound like slowed gospel chords. That dobro guitar from Lanwha plays the chords in the left ear and complements Bob's piano nicely. The chord structure of the song is a nice little sequence. It's a bit more complex than the others we've seen on this record and leads to a lovely swampy blues solo at the end. The chords they use are C, C slash E, then they go to F. Then we play around with some D shapes. Dylan gives us yet another descending melody, his trademark, towards the end of the verses as we move to an A minor and then an A minor G and then to an F and then back to C. It all sounds something like this. Like all good songs, this one seems to move with the times. Bruce Springsteen is a fan of it, apparently. He even played it on his radio show From My Home to Yours. But the context he put the song in was very interesting and very current. It all of a sudden becomes a current song despite being decades old.
Welcome, 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 my fellow travelers. This is Bruce Springsteen coming from my home to yours with Music for Troubled Times, Volume 6, titled Down to the River to Pray. May you lay your personal burdens down for a moment and join us in the next hour for some music that I hope will lighten those burdens as well as administer ever so slightly to your good soul. Now, I had another show prepared for broadcast this week on this strange and eventful summer. But with 100,000 plus Americans dying over the last few months and the empty, shamed response from our leaders, I've been simply pissed off. Those lives deserve better than just being inconvenient statistics for our president's re-election efforts. It's a national disgrace. So instead of celebrating the joys of summer today, we will be contemplating on our current circumstances with the coronavirus and the cost that it has drawn from our nation. We will be calculating what we've lost, sending prayers for the deceased and the families they've left behind. So if you are ready for a rock and roll requiem, stay tuned. I'm going to start out by sending one to the man sitting behind the Resolute desk. With all respect, sir, show some consideration and care for your countrymen and your country. Put on a fucking mask. This is Bob Dylan with The Disease of Conceit.
That song is the last song they get in this session. It was a session that had started with an attempt to capture most of the time, an ambitious song to say the least, but it was an attempt that failed. Like I said, that was the same with What Was It You Wanted, but with Political World in the can and then Disease of Conceit, the session had paid off. It seems they had finished that day with just Bob and Dan in the studio alone once more. Cyril Neville and the rest of the band had gone home, leaving Dylan alone to cut with his producer. One would suggest going back to most of the time, but they must have felt the hour was getting late. The song would have to wait. It would have to wait for another day and another session. It was a session that would take a whole lot of work and a whole lot of innovation to finally get their masterpiece. That's something we look at next time.